It's difficult today as a Christian to show one's face in public and to hold to the truth claims of Christianity. It's not because the truth claims are anything to be ashamed of. Of course they are not. It's just more difficult today because the challenges come from so many quarters. Now, that's not anything new. What is perhaps new is that the challenges are more popular than they have ever been. And they are accepted with by the populace, general population, in the naked public square, the arena of ideas. They are accepted uncritically. You know, in the first centuries of Christianity, when someone challenged the veracity of the truth claims of this new faith, they probably did so on the basis of a sound understanding of some worldview, a consistent logical approach, but not today. Inconsistency seems to be the hobgoblin not only of little or big minds, but of an entire culture. We're beginning a series, a seven-part weekly series, on testing the truth claims of Christianity. Our guest for this series, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, we're going to be talking in this first part about the fundamental incompatibility of all religions, in particular Christianity and of all other religions. That's one of those uncritically accepted truths. All religions are the same, and it does leave some Christians stammering and sputtering, not knowing how to respond. After today, you will know how to respond. If you have a question or a comment as we begin this series, our phone number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. We also have an in-studio email address where we take questions and comments live here in the studio. The address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's Barrister at Law in England and Wales and a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and author and editor of more than 50 books, including his latest, some call this his opus magnum, Tractatus Logico Theologicus. First question, Dr. Montgomery, that's a hefty title there. I'll ask a good Lutheran question. What does it mean?
Well, it's a Latin title, of course. It's a takeoff from what is generally considered to be the greatest philosophical work of the 20th century, the Tractatus Logico Philosophicus, done by Ludwig Wittgenstein. These titles mean simply logical philosophical tractate or logical theological tractate. And I'm appalled that you would feel that your readers wouldn't know a little Latin. I mean, everyone realizes, for example, that the proper translation of Sic transit gloria mundi is Gloria went home sick on Monday.
All right, you know, that's the kind of joke that only a Latin scholar would laugh at. So what am I doing laughing at it? Well, unfortunately, we're all products of what I mentioned at the very beginning, Dr. Montgomery, kind of the uncritically, the unexamined proposition. We're going to try and sally forth here, the two of us, to talk about the fundamental incompatibility of all religions, and in particular of Christianity, with all other world religions by proceeding in a very critical and examined way. You have approached the challenges to the truth claims of Christianity from just about every angle in your long career. How do you respond to the person who says that Christianity isn't distinct, it's just another cultural phenomenon among many, and all religions, including Christianity, are basically and essentially the same?
Well, the only way that one can say this is by not having any clear idea as to what the religions of the world actually maintain. If one doesn't know what the position of the various world religions happens to be on major topics or minor topics, then of course one can assume that they're all saying the same thing, but the moment that one actually investigates what the world's religions are saying, the conclusion is inevitable, that they cannot possibly all be right. They might all be wrong, but they surely cannot be all correct. It was Edgar Sheffield Brightman, the personalist philosopher at Boston University, who used to say that a universe in which both Christian Science and Roman Catholicism could both be true would be a cosmic madhouse.
Now, you begin this tractate on logical and theological propositions by making this, and it flies in the face of common wisdom. The characteristic most fully shared by the religions of the world is their incompatibility with each other. Make a defense.
Well, the reason that I start there is because as long as people have this utterly incorrect idea that all religions are saying the same thing, they're never going to bother to test the truth claims of any one religion. So what we've got to do at the very beginning is to beat down the politically correct idea that everybody is right when it comes to religion, and the various religions are nothing more than a matter of personal preference as to what one would like to believe. The whole purpose of this tractate of mine is to get at the issue of religious truth. So I have to kill at the outset the idea that the religions of the world are saying the same thing, and therefore there's no real point in checking this out. Today, there is a powerful tendency, especially in the United States, but of course not limited to the United States, to confuse tolerance with truth issues. We're not talking about the issue of tolerance. In an open society such as that in the United States, you are not going to go to jail or be exported because you hold to an incorrect religious position. People have the right to be wrong within the constitutional systems of modern democracies, and that's as it should be. But we mustn't then conclude that because everybody is allowed to believe whatever the person wants to, that it's perfectly all right to believe whatever one wants to. If Christianity is true, then the biblical position is that if you err in this regard, if you make the wrong religious decisions, then the consequences are horrible. It's like medicine or any other field. If you take the wrong medicine for whatever is ailing you, that can kill you. And a bad religion has horrifying effects, not just socially. Look at the 11th September. Not just socially, but personally, in terms of what is going to happen to the individual who attaches the wagon of his life to a star that's going to burn out.
Why is this this kind of relativity of truth and this new definition of tolerance, why is it applied especially to religious propositions and not to say mathematical propositions or scientific propositions? Those seem, by and large, to be somewhat immune from this new definition of tolerance. In other words, if I say 2 + 2 = 5, virtually everyone will not be willing to tolerate that answer, especially if I'm their accountant.
Well, that's quite correct, though political correctness carried to its logical conclusion ends up in a general solipsism. And it's for this reason that in discussions in universities among students these days, you will even find students saying that they ought not to criticize even Hitler, that Hitler's attitude toward the death camps and that sort of thing was, after all, his own viewpoint. And since we each have our own story to tell, and none of us has the right to criticize anybody else for the story that they tell, therefore we have to leave all of these positions side by side. And of course that points up the absurdity and the terrific danger in a viewpoint like this. Now, you're quite right, though, that in general in our society, except among the doctrinaire politically correct, the attitude is that in religion, it makes no difference what you believe as long as you're sincere, but people don't take that attitude in mathematics and otherwise. And it seems to me that the reason for that is that people are not, in the first place, threatened by mathematical and historical and theoretical questions to the extent that they are threatened by the religious issue. When Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life, no man comes to the Father but by me," that really gets people's attention, and they are frightened by that sort of thing. They don't want to have to face that. So it becomes much easier to take the view that, after all, no matter what it appears on the surface to be, the religions of the world are in fact saying the same thing, and therefore we don't really need to worry about all of this. I think to a very large extent, this problem in the religious area is a deep-seated moral problem. People simply don't want to face their condition, and they don't want to face the only solution possible for fear that will simply put them in a position where they're no longer in control of their own lives.
Under the general proposition that the characteristic most fully shared by all the religions of the world is their mutual incompatibility with one another, you assert that this incompatibility is at its root logical and not sociological. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, what we mean is it isn't just a matter of observing practices among the world's religions that leads us to a conclusion that they are incompatible with each other. It isn't just the fact that Muslims will not worship in a church and Christians won't worship in a mosque. The incompatibility is inherent in the actual belief systems of the various religions. So, for example, in Christianity, Jesus is God Almighty, a member of the Holy Trinity, come to earth to die for the sins of the world. Now, that is not only wrong from the standpoint of a Muslim. That is a disgusting and horrifying idea that God should have a son, and that people should depend upon a son of God for salvation. Now, there's no way in the world that those two religious positions can both be true. And we can take up, as I have in my Tractatus, any number of examples of this, the view of the human personality, the view of sin and evil in the world, the view of the nature of eternal life. If you go across the board to the various religions of the world, you will find that in no instance are they all saying the same thing on the subject, and worse than that, what they're saying directly contradicts what the others are saying.
Now, this cacophony of contradictory voices sounds to many like, in fact, people singing in beautiful four-part harmony. What reasons, understandable reasons, would someone hear all of this confusion and mistake it for, well, they're all saying the same thing?
Well, for one thing, today, religion, in the minds of many people, is reduced to morality and ethics. And if you look at the various religions of the world, you will find that there is an overlap in moral teachings. The overlap is exactly what people want to hear. So they pay attention to those instances where the several religions of the world appear to be proclaiming the same kind of ethical approach to things. For example, you don't find religions of the world saying go out and steal. Religions of the world in general are against stealing, etc. Now, the problem with this is that if you objectively look at the entire gamut, the entire scope of moral teachings among the religions of the world, you find as many instances of contradiction there as you do in regard to the metaphysical matters, the nature of God, and that sort of thing. Take, for example, the Muslim attitude toward women. The Muslim views a woman essentially as a chattel. And it's possible for the husband to divorce the wife simply by announcing this in the presence of witnesses. This is the so-called talaq. And the woman doesn't have that privilege or opportunity whatsoever. And in the history of Islam, women have been treated just despicably. No question about this. Contrast Christianity, where we hear in the New Testament that there is neither Jew nor Greek, neither bond nor free, neither male nor female. Ye are all one in Jesus Christ. And so on down the line. So what people do is selectively look at the religions of the world, and they take those things which appear to be compatible, and they ignore the stuff that isn't. One example of this some years ago was a book published by UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, a book on human rights. And what the editors did was to go through the various religions of the world and cull from them sweetness and light statements about the human race. And this book looks as if all the religions of the world have exactly the same human rights position. Now, this is patently ridiculous. The fact is that you can't get people in the Far East or people in the Near East even to create regional human rights systems, because they know perfectly well that if such systems came into existence, like the European system for human rights protection, their governments would be dragged before international courts for all sorts of violations which their own religious positions are willing to condone. So the fact of the matter is that people just get what they want in looking at this ethical situation. They want the religions of the world to be holding to the same ethic, and by George, by ignoring all the instances where they don't, one gets precisely what one wanted in the first place.
Here in America, to what degree has pop American evangelicalism, kind of the moral majority wing of the American church, contributed to this mistaken notion that religion, including Christianity, is nothing more than just a moral code?
Well, I think the old moral majority really did fall into this, because they became so preoccupied with improving the ethical level in the states that they jumped into bed with other religionists who were not at all Christian in their approach, simply because there appeared to be a common ground in the areas where they were trying to get public concern expressed. You had situations where, for example, the moral majority felt entirely comfortable with Mormons and Christian Scientists and people of that ilk, because all of them were against what? Teenage lascivious sexual practices, and all of them wanted a more solid family life. There's been a big tendency. Pat Robertson has fallen into this. He's gotten this perspective on the importance of family values, and then he makes no distinctions whatsoever between Roman Catholics and Mormons and other people, as long as they maintain the same kind of view on family values. And it seems to me that, I mean, of course we want to create coalitions with others in order to improve society. Even Buddhists presumably can cooperate with Christians on garbage collection and that sort of thing. But if we're not very, very careful, when we put a religious stamp on all of this, as Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell do, this just aids and abets the idea that everybody really believes the same thing. And this is utterly wrong, and as long as people have that idea, they're certainly not going to see any reason to face the claims of Jesus Christ.
It seems as though something that does need explanation here is that not only are world religions not reducible to their moral codes, but all the characteristics of a religion, whatever it may be, cannot be kind of isolated from one another in different slots. We're really talking about overarching motifs that each religion, that drives each religion, that makes them incompatible with one another.
Yes, I've made this point very strongly in the first section of the Tractatus. Let's say that we did have a common morality presented by five or six world religions. Let's say that just as they all prohibit stealing, let us say, they likewise prohibited other moral practices in common, and they promoted the same kind of ethical conduct. That still would not eliminate incompatibility as long as the moral values are not understood as having the same function religiously. Now, what I mean by this is that in many religions of the world, the function of morality is so that we can pull ourselves up to heaven by our own bootstraps. The better we are, the more we're going to satisfy the cosmic forces, the gods of the universe, the supreme beings, however we conceive of them. Whereas in Christianity, for example, all of the ethical and moral efforts that you and I can engage in, all the huffing and puffing ethically, will never bring us to heaven. Because in Christianity, it is realized, and this is in accord with the best of psychoanalysis and the greatest world literature, we are radically self-centered. And when we engage in moral conduct, it's usually to make ourselves look better before other people, or at minimum, to make ourselves feel good. And it is in no sense a means of salvation. Morality in most religions turns out to be a means of salvation. In Christianity, there is not a single thing you can do ethically to save yourself. In fact, what you need to do is to arrive at the point where you are willing to admit that all your righteousness is as filthy rags, and you are desperately in need of what Jesus has done for us on the cross. And without that, there is no way in the world that ethics will help you in any way. Ethics in Christianity helps in the reverse, in a way, because by analyzing your ethical condition, you discover just how self-centered you are and how desperately you need what God has done on the cross by grace.
When we come back from this break, we're going to take up the issue of God. Some would say, well, don't all religions have a concept of God? Don't all religions say that God is really the ultimate concern? Well, that may be, in some minds, an example of how religions are compatible with one another. However, I suspect that Dr. Montgomery will show that that is just another way of demonstrating the incompatibility of all religions. Our guest, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, is director and professor in residence for the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, which is held annually in Strasbourg, France. Now, it's too late to attend this year's Academy, so you'd better register early for 2004. If you'd like a free information brochure on the 8th Annual European Summer Study of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, you can call 1-800-737-0172. That's our automated resource line, 1-800-737-0172, and we'll send you a free brochure, or you can check out our website at issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, and under the section titled What's New, you'll find information on this academy. Don't wait and miss out on next year's academy. 1-800-737-0172. When we come back from this break, what exactly do the world's religions say of God? And is that a way of demonstrating their compatibility with one another, or their incompatibility? Our phone number, 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. We'll be back with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The Apostles' Creed is a confession of faith almost as old as the Christian church itself. What does this ancient creed have to say to Christians today? And does the church still need creeds? For answers to these questions, I recommend a new book called To All Eternity, The Essential Teachings of Christianity. Here's how you order this great new resource. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and under the What's New section, you'll find a link to Concordia Publishing House. Or call 1-800-325-3000. 3040 and ask to receive the Issues Etc. Book of the Month, To All Eternity, The Essential Teachings of Christianity. 1-800-325-3040 during regular business hours. Or go to our website, issuesetc.org, click What's New, and there you'll find information on how to order To All Eternity.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. President Clinton once called Illinois the Calcutta of the child welfare system. But state lawmakers turned disaster into hope in the 90s by privatizing much of the foster care program. Now, two recent incidents of abuse have liberals calling for a return to state management. Bob Kellogg has the story.
Margaret Berglund of the Child Care Association of Illinois freely admits the system is far from perfect.
Certainly there are incidents. Certainly the system is not yet perfect, but we are still viewed as a national leader.
But Berglund thinks privatization has helped immensely because private nonprofit agencies bring in extra money as charities.
That helps increase the quality of work that we do and the number of services that we can provide for children and families that are part of the system.
Donna Jones of the Illini Children's Christian Ministries, who once worked for the Department of Child and Family Services, talks about a shortcoming.
DCFS is cutting back so much on their staff that they just do not have the amount of staff that they need to be able to monitor everybody.
Jones thinks the best situation is where she is now, a Christian organization funded by churches. She says, unfortunately, there are too few, and many churches need to be made aware of the importance of Christian foster care.
We don't want children to be raised in non-Christian, you know, secular environment, rather than be raised in a Christian environment. And then hopefully be able to touch their parents and get the kids back home and get them in a, you know, on a Christian walk rather than lost in a big bureaucracy of DCFS.
Berglund says a serious cutback during this economic downturn could further jeopardize the state's program. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Kellogg.
Jones laments that many churchgoers think foster care is a function of the state, and she says she spends quite a bit of time in churches explaining how they can make a difference. Jones extols the ministry opportunities in foster care and encourages Christians to get involved. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Salem Lutheran Church in Blackjack presents a program each Saturday afternoon at 5 p.m. called Salem Prelude. It's a half hour of organ music and commentary to prepare you for worship, to keep you in touch with the liturgical emphasis of each season. The Salem Prelude serves as a time for you to meet in quiet devotion with our Lord. Join the members of Salem Lutheran Church in Blackjack for Salem Prelude each Saturday at 5 p.m. on AM 850 KFUO.
What are the essential teachings of Christianity? Find out with the new book, To All Eternity, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. To All Eternity is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org. Click What's New. To All Eternity, the Essential Teachings of Christianity, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're beginning a seven-part weekly series on testing the truth claims of Christianity, and today we're talking about the fundamental incompatibility of all religions, including Christianity, with all other religions. Our guest, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's barrister at law in England and Wales and a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and he is author and editor of more than 50 books, including his latest and his greatest, called Tractatus Logico Theologicus. Dr. Montgomery, briefly tell us about this new book.
Well, it was begun 35 years ago, of all things. The greatest philosophical work of the 20th century is generally regarded as the first of two books that Ludwig Wittgenstein did. Wittgenstein revolutionized modern philosophy by analyzing in a series of seven propositions and sub-propositions the question as to how one could arrive at truth on any level whatsoever. And his conclusion was that there are really two kinds of statements. There are statements that are definitional in nature, and you demonstrate those by understanding the meaning of the definition. And there are questions of fact, and those questions have got to be resolved by investigating the nature of the world. Wittgenstein longed for an eternal answer to the ultimate meaning of things, and he said that any ultimate values would have to come from outside the world. They would have to arrive transcendentally. He says in the sixth proposition of his Tractatus that ethics is transcendental, but he never was able to arrive at this. My former professor at Cornell University, Norman Malcolm, who was a student of Wittgenstein and a close friend of his, says in his little biography of Wittgenstein that Wittgenstein would often, as he was walking, say, "Oh my God," as if imploring a divine intervention. Anyway, he didn't find this, and he ends his great work, the Tractatus, with the statement, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. In other words, philosophers ought to shut up when they can't arrive at any transcendental sources for ultimate knowledge. What I determined that I would do is to take that same structure of seven basic propositions and show that on the basis of the evidence for Christian revelation, we do have that absolute answer for which Wittgenstein and the whole philosophical tradition has been longing. And so my seven propositions end with, whereof one can speak, one must not remain silent. And therefore, this book that I have done is really a comprehensive defense of the Christian faith, taking the ultimate truth questions and providing the evidence to show that God was in Christ reconciling the world unto himself, and the scriptures are indeed an inerrant, infallible word from God, and we do, therefore, have the transcendent answers that we need to the problems of the human situation.
And folks, despite the title in Latin, I will assure you this is one of the most engaging and accessible books, and also you get hooked on it. You really do. You start doing this in your sleep. You can purchase Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's new book, Tractatus Logico Theologicus, directly through our radio program. We'll send you the book for a contribution of $40 to Issues, etc. The price does include shipping and handling. Simply have your MasterCard, your Visa, or your Discover card ready and call our Issues, etc. resource line at 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. The book is called Tractatus Logico Theologicus, or just ask for the latest by Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. Make your $40 check payable to Issues, etc. if you prefer, and mail it to Box 9360. St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. The phone number again, 1-800-737-0172. Let's go to the phones. Ty has been waiting in his car on the line. Ty, thank you for your patience and welcome to Issues, Etc.
No problem. Dr. Montgomery, it is truly an honor to speak with you. As a Catholic, you are one of my very, very favorite Lutherans on this planet.
You're so kind.
And I would say that the little book you edited, Myth, Allegory, and the Gospel, the collection of essays, I read that at least once every 6 months. I've got an immense amount of enjoyment from that little book. And one thing I wanted to add to this conversation briefly, I think that 99.9% of the population that would say all religions are basically the same say so out of complete naivety, out of the old, well, at least the one I read is the same sort of thing. But that is not to say that there aren't a lot of people in the intelligentsia and with great scholarship that don't make the same claim. But it seems that when they do try to reconcile all the religions, they wind up making some sort of claim that in the final analysis says all religions are basically Buddhism, or all religions are basically some form of pantheism. See this from everyone from Joseph Campbell to Alan Watts. And I think it's interesting, in one of the books I read by Alan Watts, he goes through great pains to say how we just torture the beautiful Christian myth by trying to shoehorn it into the dogmatic theology we have created. And then in turn, he turns right around and tries to shoehorn the beautiful Christian myth into Buddhism. And I would just like your comments, Dr. Montgomery.
Thank you, Ty. Excellent comments and questions.
Yes, that's a very strong point. And the reason why the tendency among the intelligentsia is to turn all religions into a kind of Buddhist or Eastern mysticism is that if you endeavor to find common elements in all the religions of the world, the only way you can do this is to move away from their actual content to greater and greater formality, to greater generalization and vagueness. For example, Tillich's definition of religion as ultimate concern. Ultimate concern is about as vague and general a concept, as formal a concept as you could get to. And as you move from content to formality, you are moving in the direction of the Eastern religions, such as Hinduism and Buddhism, which have never had any really specific revelatory basis. The tendency has always been in those circles to speak in the vaguest and most general terms. One of the most amusing illustrations of this is in Arthur Koestler's The Lotus and the Robot. After Koestler spent 10 years in Marxism and managed somehow to extricate himself from that, he went to the Far East to drink at the founts of Eastern wisdom. And he says in The Lotus and the Robot that he was taken up this mountain by a monk to visit a very famous guru. And during the half hour with the guru said absolutely nothing and picked her toenails. And at the end of this, the monk, of course, took Koestler back down the mountain, and Koestler was quite discouraged by this. And the monk said to Koestler, "Ah, you should not be discouraged, because she was telling you something." Huh? Well, Koestler never figured out what it was, and neither has anybody else, but that is exactly the kind of reduction, a reductio ad absurdum, and reduction to total formality and total absence of content that you get in Eastern religions. And that's why Campbell and company arrive at that kind of a result. I had a debate at a philosophy conference with Ninian Smart, with the late Ninian Smart. Smart says that actually it may appear that the religions of the world on phenomenal grounds, phenomenological grounds, are saying something different. But if you realize that on the religious or theological level, they really are saying the same thing, then you arrive at the truth. But of course, this is just a gratuitous dualism. It begs the question, I mean, why should a higher theological level of validity exist in the face of clear phenomenological contradiction?
Now, it strikes me that this is what passes for profundity today. If you can sound as general as possible, especially when making religious-sounding statements, then people think you are more profound. The more particular you get, the more specific you get, like Jesus is Lord or Jesus is the only way of salvation, they consider that so base, almost the opposite of being profound. Is this your observation as well?
Well, yes, indeed. And because of the confusion with intolerance that we were talking about at the beginning of the program, people get nervous the more specific you are religiously. They feel uncomfortable because they sense that this is going to mean that there's an in-group and there's an out-group. But in the rest of life, we're quite well aware of this. I mean, there are those who pass examinations and there are those who don't. There are those who are athletic and those who are not. There are those who are in jail and those who are not. Life is made up of decisions, and these decisions and abilities and the like have consequences. Now, in the area of religion, what Christianity is saying is you pays your money and you take your choice. If you make the mistake of relying upon yourself for salvation, if you think you've got an ability within yourself that'll make it possible for you to make God happy so that you will enter into his courts as a result of his feeling that you are an asset to heaven, if you take that attitude, that self-centeredness is going to carry you in exactly the opposite direction. Just as if you insist upon taking a medicine which is not aspirin but arsenic for your headache, you're going to end up dead. And it appears to me that in this area, reaching a greater level of adulthood and maturity is extremely important. No longer remaining childish in this area of religious differences. These differences are real, and decisions in this area are going to have consequences, just as decisions have consequences in all other areas of life.
Our phone number is 1-800-730-2727. Larry has been waiting a while as well. Welcome to Issues Etc., Larry.
Yes, thank you for having me. I hear this a lot, so I would ask, what's your response? Someone might say, well, the reason why you don't understand our Eastern religion or such, or maybe even that the reason you're wrong is because you have a Western mind, you think differently than, say, the Easterner. What would be your response to that?
That's a good question. Dr. Montgomery.
Yes. In Hinduism, for example, and in Buddhism to a certain extent, all is Maya, all is illusion, and this is contrasted with a Western attitude toward objective reality. My tendency is to take the Hindu or the Buddhist out to a busy street corner, and as a bus is coming, this is especially effective in England because the buses are red in color, the royal color, you take them out to intersections such as Piccadilly Circus, and you say, that example of Maya that is now bearing down on us, does that represent objective reality or doesn't it? And when the person says, ah, no, it is an illusion, it is indeed Maya, you throw them out in front of it. All right? And, they then crawl up on the curb, gray in color and shaking, and then you ask them again, how real is it? The fact of the matter is that whether you're Eastern or Western, you are living in exactly the same world. Finding your way to a Chinese restaurant is done in exactly the same way as finding your way to McDonald's. And we have to get the other person, again, to a level of maturity where they see that they need to apply the very same methods that they must use to survive in this world, to avoid being run over by the bus when it comes to issues of religious truth. They can't be selective and turn off their minds when religion is concerned. In fact, that's the area where they ought to be the most careful in making their decisions, because eternity depends upon it.
You write in your new book, there are as many conflicting ways of salvation as there are religions claiming to save. Explain that.
Well, if you look at the various religions of the world, you find that each one has its own way to ultimate reality. And if you take, for our purposes, if you take all of them other than Christianity, the one common element in these various incompatible ways of salvation, the one common element is that in every case they are works righteous. That is to say, the way to satisfy eternity is by your own efforts. The various efforts are contradictory among the world's religions, and they can't be reconciled, but the fact is, in every instance, other than in Christianity, salvation is by what we do rather than by grace. And therefore, what we're facing here is an incompatibility in the understanding of what man is capable of doing. In Christianity, there is the recognition, as Freud and Adler and Jung and the great psychoanalysts have pointed out, there's a recognition that man is radically self-centered. And if that's the case, then Christianity is quite correct that man is not going to be able to satisfy God through his own efforts. Man is going to have to depend upon God to save him if he's going to be saved at all.
So we have touched also upon another fundamental of religions that at first appears to be a commonality, but on closer examination shows their incompatibility, and that is these various religions' view of man himself.
Yes, quite. That's really what we were just talking about, mm-hmm. because uh, the the religions of the world that believe that you can save yourself, of course, have a positive view of what the human being is capable of. And that's the most unrealistic thing. Because if you don't understand the disease, you are certainly not going to understand the remedy. You know, it's fundamental in medicine that, first of all, the physician has got to be correct in analyzing what the problem is. Then there's a possibility of offering a cure. But if the cure doesn't match the disease, then you are certainly going to have a mess.
Dennis is on the line. Dennis, welcome to Issues Etc. Thank you for calling.
Hi. How are you doing, Todd?
Very well.
And Dr. Montgomery, how are you today?
Excellent. Thank you.
I have a question with all due respect, and it's in regards to I know that you believe in biblical inerrancy, and some of the arguments against biblical inerrancy are the fact that there are clear contradictions within the scriptures themselves. Now, how do you reconcile some of the contradictions, particularly the synoptic gospel, some of the problems that they have in terms of incidents that were recorded, and then they seem to contradict each other? As a Christian apologist, how do you reconcile those differences?
Would you want to provide any example of such a contradiction?
Well, for example, the statement that Christ, many Christians believe that Christ is God himself. However, it's clear that he makes a distinction between himself and God in certain scriptures of the Gospels, where he's asking God to take this cup from him, and he prays to God. And so it's quite obvious that he's not praying to himself. If Jesus is God, then how can he be praying to himself? This is an argument that I get frequently from other Christians or non-Christians.
That's an interesting example, because, of course, that's not a contradiction at all. It would only be a contradiction if he said, I am only man and not God. As long as God is Trinitarian in nature, then it is perfectly possible for the persons of the Godhead to communicate with each other. Therefore, the Father says from heaven, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased, and Jesus speaks to the Father. So that's not a contradiction. And the interesting thing is that when contradictions are talked about, in quotation marks, the people who raise this issue invariably don't understand what a logical contradiction is. In the Gospels, you will have certain events that are similar, some taking place at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, some at the end. For example, the cleansing of the temple. There would only be a contradiction in such instances if in each case it's stated that such an event could only have taken place once. Fact of the matter is, Jesus cleaned out the temple at the beginning of his ministry, and he cleaned out the temple at the end of the ministry, and considering the condition of the temple, it's a wonder he didn't do it every Saturday night. Okay? So you ought to know what a contradiction is first, and then after. And by the way, where there are difficulties, the principle of literary criticism that needs to be used, and it's used for Shakespeare and everything else, is that you give the benefit of the doubt to the author. If there is a writing, just like a defendant, is innocent until proven guilty. So the burden of proof rests upon the critic to show that this must be contradictory, and that has not been able to be shown. Go to Gleason Archer's Encyclopedia of Biblical Difficulties, for example, and you'll find more than enough reconciliations to handle those problems.
Now, I wanted to end in a kind of a practical way. The tolerance we discussed at the beginning of this conversation, and then the notion, the mistaken notion that we've pretty well put to bed, that all religions are essentially compatible with one another, has its manifestation in our modern world, in particular among people who are ostensibly Christians, in the radical ecumenical movement and other ecumenical religions. What do you make of those who, on the basis of their belief that all religions are fundamentally compatible with one another, say we really ought to be seeking a real practical, real grassroots unity among the religions?
Well, what we've been saying before, that if you move in this direction, you're going to be moving away from content and toward vague generalities and formality, applies so very, very clearly in the ecumenical movement. I mean, what goes on there is that churches that are weak theologically of course, lose membership because people don't go to church for pure formality. If you want pure formality, what? You can study plane geometry or something. People go to church because they want concrete salvation. They want to have some word from God that they can depend upon. So these vague liberal churches get more and more vague and more liberal, and they constantly lose members. The people go off and join the Rotary Club, which is much more fun. The food is better. As a result of this, in order to survive, these churches enter into ecumenical unions with other churches of similar vagueness. And the progress or regress, if you will, is always to less and less rather than to more and more. So when you get churches like the United Church of Christ, let's say, no one can figure out if they actually believe anything. The end result is that even though they may still exist, they exist because churches have entered into the union that has created them after losing membership, and the membership continues to go down. There probably ought to be an antitrust law against such churches. They are not accomplishing anything. Heavens, even in terms of eleemosynary work, helping the poor, the Salvation Army is doing immensely more. I think it was Malcolm Muggeridge who said he was yet to find a liberal leper colony.
Dr. Montgomery, next time we're going to take up the issue, and we only have about 30 seconds here for your brief tease of next week's program, Pilate's question of what is truth?
Well, yes, if the religions of the world are mutually contradictory and they can't all be true, the question comes down very hard. How can we determine which one, if any, is true? So we're going to deal with some serious philosophical reasoning as to how you can demonstrate anything, and in particular, how you could demonstrate the truth of a religious position.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, thank you again for being our guest.
Most welcome.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, this is part one of a 7-part series on testing the truth claims of Christianity. If you'd like to receive a complimentary copy of our Issues Etc. journal, or if you'd like to purchase Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's new book, Tractatus Logico Theologicus, for a total of $40, or if you'd like to make a donation to Issues Etc., call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172, or write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Well, statements that sound quite Buddhist and are pretenders to Christian truth, about how all religions are basically the same, God is love, the basic ethic is love your neighbor, all reducing and boiling down in one big pot the religions of the world to one common goo, they sound profound. It might pass for profundity today, but it won't pass for Christianity. Christianity is annoyingly particular and specific about who we are before God, sinners, deserving death, and who that God is, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and how he has brought us again to himself through the forgiveness of our sins, namely, the incarnation, the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.